when Prabhupada spoke about cultural conquest, some people think he meant Bharatanatyam dancing or something. But this is cultural conquest. So it's there are persons who look at what's going on in America or in the world and just take any piece of it that's really ugly, like domestic violence or child abuse or gun violence, or and they want to make a change. But it goes deeper, it goes to a culture level, and you know, Krishna culture is how we see what we do. It's a nice topic to talk about. There's culture within our community. There's culture within our family or families, and our families relate and interrelate with one another. Krishna culture. How we address differences, how we respect differences and resolve differences when there's a conflict and difference. It's in the medical profession, certainly Krishna culture is part of changing the hearts and the lives of people. It's the medical treatment, but it's the culture that you carry. Anyway, you're affecting the lives of people, and that they, at least some, are seeing you as a follower of Krishna or a devotee of Krishna or a member of the Krishna group or something like that. Of Krishna's, it's a beginning. Krishna culture. I've said this on several occasions. It seems appropriate just reflecting on the appreciation, this particular video that's circulating around. Our communications minister, Anutama Prabhu, whenever he gets the chance of speaking about strategic planning and building the future and ISKCON 100 and things like that, I like speaking about, we have to read Prabhupada's books, and he likes speaking about, we have to begin reaching out to audiences that are influential in the world besides our own group, and connecting with those people. Intellectuals, government people, interfaith interaction, and be seen not as a small group of people that have a fence around them and they're isolationists and maybe a little bit snobby, thinking, you know, we're better and we don't want to connect with people that aren't living on or something like that. I don't think that we think that way, that people think that we think that way. And like what Rangopal is doing is in that category of reaching out to people who can then understand and appreciate Krishna consciousness because of his representation of us as a member of our organization. Not everybody can do that service and remain strong.
But Inuto was sharing this particular experience in Washington, D.C., which is where he lives. Well, he lives near Washington, D.C. in Maryland, but in the D.C. area. He's been going for years to interfaith groups and mixing with, you know, movers and shakers in different organizations, not just people that are priests and speak to a congregation, but people who are shakers and movers in the whole of their larger body of followers. And I've heard this from him twice. It apparently made a big impression on him. One of those persons way up on that ladder of hierarchy and respect, in the move that the minds of others, said, in Christianity, we often speak about how God loves you or how Christ loves you. But you're always speaking about loving God and how to serve Him. And I like that. Which means he's going to start speaking the Krishna conscious message to his audiences. That's what it means. And although they're not going to become Hare Krishna sadhakas, they'll start to view things in the way that culture change takes place, where it's some deeper conviction that you have. A core conviction is not just God loves you and Christ died for your sins, so everything's okay. But just turning it around, and that this particular example at least of serving God, not that no Christians think that way, but it's a cultural change. And it starts on our serious members interacting with other people, where they know that you're a devotee and you're accepting of them for who they are, and you're being who you are. You're being a devotee in the midst of everything that is different than how devotees are. You're in the workplace where people do things, eat things, drink things, talk about things other than what devotees talk about, and you're unmoved by that, and you're a little example of a Krishna devotee in that sphere. It's a dramatic change. Something that I've just been asked to do is I'm sharing this a little bit with Jumana Jivana because he deals with some of these same ideas at WashU, but at University of Texas in Austin, I'm going to be visiting there, and there's a social activist group that it's there every Monday. They go to some place, a quad or some public place near a statue of somebody or other, and you know, make their demonstration about, you know, gun-free University of Texas, and sending messages to the governor and to the senators, and, you know, trying to change the gun laws and from the student population to the government people, and to, of course, to their own administration and so on. Now I'm supposed to speak about that. So social activism and spirituality and how they intersect. And one of the messages is going to be, you can change the laws, but without changing the culture, it's just going to shift the problem from this place to that place, without changing the culture. And what does changing the culture mean? It has something to do with the way that you go about, even if you go about trying to be a Martin Luther King or a Mahatma Gandhi, that if there isn't a means of bringing people to a spiritual paradigm, then racial discrimination was still going to go on, and you know, it was because he's in the news these days, Martin Luther King, 50 years later, struggle still goes on. It's very deeply rooted. So, yeah, some social activism and nonviolent civil disobedience movement and some change, certainly some change. But a lot of things haven't changed also. Let's see if the students like that idea, the student activists in particular. Cultural revolution. Okay, enough on that. So I wanted to do two things this evening. One is share this thing that I mentioned before, few evenings ago. A topic came up during one discussion, morning Bhagavatam class at the Naperville Center, and somebody asked the following question. The Vedas speak of the spiritual realm being the three-quarters portion and the material realm being the one-quarter portion, but how does it work if Krishna is unlimited, Krishna's abode is unlimited, so how can you have three-fourths of something unlimited? And say that the rest is one-fourth. How does that work? I thought it was a nice question, intriguing question. It wasn't just a information question, it was a thoughtful question. So, in response to the question, that's where this comes from. The purpose, well, there's twofold purposes of taking you through this exercise. Stir a little controversy. That's good because it gets people thinking instead of dull. And some appreciation for the Vedas of how they deal with helping us understand the spiritual and material and how they intersect, how they fit. The Vedas come from the Supreme Lord. They're as eternal, they're co-eternal with Narayana or Krishna himself. They're not creations after some time. Within the Vedas, there's full knowledge of everything. Just as within the Supreme Lord, there's full knowledge of everything. Satchit Ananda, Vigraha, without limit. But they're also by nature merciful, as the Lord is by nature merciful, and the intention is to help help a conditioned soul on the floor.
Yes.
Brown shoulder bag. The merciful nature of Krishna and the merciful nature of the Vedas and the merciful nature of those who represent Krishna and the Vedas. They're basically to help us come to the spiritual position once again. Anybody here familiar with this word, hermeneutics? the branch of knowledge that deals with interpretation of a text. And commonly, hermeneutics is used, at least in the Christian world, in the world that we live in the West is the Christian world, is the Bible. How do you read the Bible? How do you understand a particular passage or text from the Bible? That's hermeneutics. And the study of the methodological principles of interpretation. So this is a hermeneutics exercise. And just to share something with you, there's a project that's 4 years in the making of Sanskritists within ISKCON, Sri Dayananda Maharaj and Radhika Raman and others and others and others, that Krishna Kshetra Swami, how are we to understand Srila Prabhupada's books? It's called a hermeneutics paper. And a group of 5, 6, 7 devotees spent 3 years making, then revising, and then revising. Now it's in its 4th revision, working on the 5th revision. Within ISKCON, there's a Shastra Advisory Committee. It's got an acronym like everything these days, SAC. Shastra Advisory Committee. They took version 3 and made version 4, and it's only 136 pages. But by the time that they're done, it'll probably be more like 180, and then they'll probably have like a 30-page primer that you can go through and get like the essence, and then you have referrals to other sections. How to understand yourself from different angles of vision. Prabhupada's texts, because each of us, or groups of us, I suppose, we probably have our idea of how you read Prabhupada's books, how do you understand a certain passage. And then there's another group of persons, and you just let that go out over time, and you got schisms. And to avoid schisms, there's an interest and an effort to have, not like this is the right way to read or that's the right way, but as it says, methodological principles that should be applied when reading Prabhupada's books. On any particular topic that you'd like to look at. Whatever take the topic. Varnashram. What is the message that we are to take from Prabhupada's books about Varnashram? In this age of Kali, when the Sankirtan, the Yuga Dharma is Harinam Sankirtan, what's the place of Varnashram? The discussion with Ramananda Roy and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about Varnashram and everything, the whole thing. What are the principles? Not what's the right answer, wrong answer, but what are the principles to be involved when you look at a text or a set of teachings? That's what hermeneutics is. So stay tuned. There'll probably be a few more years before they have something there's this language now called a foundational document, which means it's meant to not just address something today, but something that can be referred to generations later. And it may be revised kind of like the canon law of the Catholic Church, how you're to interpret a particular subject. It's not like a definitive statement on the subject, it's how you understand the body of literature of the Srila Prabhupada, the founder of Chani Vaiskhan established. Okay? So this is a little bit of a hermeneutics exercise. Whoa. Can we do a little reset? Let's do a whole reset. So, there's going to be three topics, Atma, Paramatma, and then there's three quarters, one quarter. And there are statements within the Vedas that use material measurements for something that's spiritual. Like the Atma, Atma meaning the soul. And Samkhya teaches us something about the soul. It doesn't give a material measurement, but it describes the soul as Satchit and Ananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. It's eternally existent, it's cognizant, and it's blissful. And there's coverings of the soul, the subtle body, the gross body, and then there's the soul within. So that's what we're speaking about, the Atma, because it can refer to the body and the mind. Okay, but it refers to, in this case, the Atma, the soul. Anybody that's heard Srila Prabhupada speak on this topic is very familiar with this phrase, Kesha Garshata Bhagasya. Kesha means hair, and Agra means tip. So the soul is the size of a fraction of the tip of a hair. Chaitanya Charitamrita speaks like this. Keshagra Shatabhagasha Shatam Sha Sadrashatmaka. So the Jiva Sukshma, I put in bold letters, It has to do with its spiritual nature. Very fine. Here's the translation from Chaitanya Charitamrita. There are innumerable particles of spiritual atoms which are measured as 1/10,000th of the upper portion of the hair. That very fine division is the size. That's this jiva sukshma. That very fine division is the size of but one of the numberless living entities. They are all chitkana, that's this phrase here, chitkana, particles of spirit, not matter. I spoke on this topic at College Station, Texas A&M. And in the audience was a PhD student in the field of something. Maybe you know this one. He said, the tip of a hair immediately, just like right in the middle of the presentation, the tip of a hair is so many angstrom units. Are you familiar? Yes? The tip of a hair has already got a measurement to it. And 1/10,000th, he said, is it's 100 angstrom units. Something like that. So, tip of a hair is measurable. And at least according to theoretical physics, you can divide something that's measurable into 10,000 parts, at least mathematically. Whether you can do it physically or not is another thing, but you know, by math you can say it's what it is. So there's a physical measurement for something that's not physical. The Sri Tashvatara Upanishad gives a similar but slightly different, in principle it's the same, Balagra Sata Shatabhagasya, is how it begins. This is very specific. When the upper point of a hair is divided into 100 parts, and again, each such part is further divided into 100 parts, each such part is the measurement of the dimension of the spirit soul. Now, again, mathematically, you can say what the size is. Practically speaking, you can't make such a division. You can't get a particle divider that cuts, you know, gets out a knife or somehow cuts something into that size. But it can give you, it gives you an idea. Now, we know that people can't see the soul. One of the reasons they can't see the soul is because it's not material. And the eyes can see that which is material, but cannot see something that's in another range of energy, spiritual energy, you can't see with material eyes. But we can't see an atom either. Has, in modern science, have they seen an atom? With, they can smash an atom, but can they see one? Is there such a microscope that can see an atom? I'm asking.
Yeah, what do you mean by seeing, actually? Seeing by...
What do I mean by seeing an atom? Like, you know, there's one. Like that. Physically see. Yes? No? No?
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Okay. According, there's another reference, scriptural reference, that says, again, all this is just to stir you to, you know, feel a little uncomfortable and thinking a little more than you might otherwise think. So, we have this nice verse from Brahma Samhita, text number 35, the one that starts, Eko Pyaso Rachayatam Jagadandakotim, and then in big letters, Andantarasta Paramanu Chayantarastam. So, in big letters is Parama Anu. That's describing the atom. Parama Anu, or Paramanu. The translation of that line in red, all the universes exist in him, and he is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. Now, hey, that's contradictory. How many universes are there? Too many to count. There's a finite number, but too many to count. That's how many. And all of those universes are within him. This is the, speaking of the Purusha. That's what this verse is defining. The Purusha avatars. All the universes are within him, and he, in his fullness, is within each one of the Parama Anus, in his fullness, at the same time. Not back and forth and back and forth, but at the same time. And where there is Paramatma, where there is Krishna alone, or Krishna is with his living entity? Krishna is with his living entity. So just as there's Paramatma within the heart, there's Paramatma within every Parama Anu, and there's a soul within every Parama Anu. There's a teaching that comes from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Again, I'm just trying to stir you into being, you know, thoughtful. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is having a discussion with Haridas Thakur. And Haridas Thakur says, my dear Lord Chaitanya, this is Antyalila, my dear Lord Chaitanya, by your appearing in this world, you've liberated all living entities, moving and non-moving. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Haridas, consider what you're saying. There's so many trees and so many animals and birds and insects, and you see them, there they are. How can you say they've been delivered? And Haridas says it's true. They've been delivered, and the non-moving living entities, they've taken their place. What's non-moving living entity? It's not just the chara and akshara, you know, the ones that have legs and ones that don't have legs, like plants and trees, they can't move. But not just that kind of, you know, they don't move with legs. Just living entities are everywhere. Yes? Kavita Bhagavad Gita, Sarva, Gita, they're everywhere. Like, where is there not a living entity? The answer, they're everywhere. Just like super souls, everywhere. So, the soul is smaller than an atom. And the soul is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. And no one is, well, depends on what we need and whether people have seen an atom or not. What's the Vedic definition of an atom? Well, Parama Anu is one of the terminologies. Here's right from our Bhagavad Gita purport. The Lord is Vibhu, or omniscient, but the living entity is Anu, or atomic. Atomic meaning tiny. And and there's a whole chapter, Canto 3, Chapter 11, Calculation of Time by the Atom, where this is a definition. The atom is the minute, subtle form of eternal time. Don't ask me to explain it, please. But there's eternal time that exists in the spiritual realm, and then there's time as we know it in the material realm. And that just like there's an object in the shadow of an object, this time as we know it is illusory time. But that illusory time moves things. It moves matter. I mean, there was a time we weren't sitting here. And then now we're sitting here. And then there's going to be a time where we disperse. And it's... time moves matter. Say it in verse. If you want to be a god, you have to have time energy under your control. Because you have to have time. And to bring dissolution, it's very simple. You just withdraw time. And the whole thing collapses. Time is sustaining and supporting the creation. So there's eternal time and there's time as we know it, and time as we know it, the smallest according to this chapter 11, the smallest measure of time is the time it takes for the sun to cross one atom. And then so many of those makes another unit, and so many of those makes another unit, and so many of those makes another unit, and you get creation. Two prarardhas is the duration of the life of Brahma. And then there's the night, or excuse me, the cosmic annihilation is of equal duration, and time as we know it keeps cycling and cycling in big and small cycles. But that's time. Then the atom is the minute, subtle form of eternal time. I don't know how to explain that one. The minute, subtle form of eternal time. subtle form of eternal time. Time agitates pradhan, and then the elements unfold. Just like we heard in the Bhagavatam class. Again, I'm just doing this to like churn your thoughts. Not so much like, oh, I get it. Jud Bharat, in the morning Bhagavatam class that we're reading from the temple, he's having this nice discussion with the king, King Mahugana. And he's telling the king that there are persons that have this idea that the primordial substance of all things is the atoms. Well, there's Kanada that has a whole doctrine that says that. You familiar? There's six doctrines or theses. They're expositions of the Vedas, and one of those six is Kanada's, and it's Paramanuvada, or atomic theory. And he says, the essence, the primordial essence of everything is the atom. It's the same as mechanistic science. It says, all there is matter, and the laws give governing matter, and there's nothing else. When you say, well, where does the matter and the laws governing matter come from? You want to say it's God, and we say that's God. There's matter and the laws governing matter. So there. It's an atheistic view. You don't need God. You just have matter and the laws governing matter. So what Jud Bharata tells the king, standing in the middle of the field with the palanquin by their side, is where's the atom come from? He said there's Prabhupada comments, there's particles within the atom, but then, you know, how do the particles assemble to make an atom? There's the avyakta state, where there aren't even particles, or at least they go back into their unmanifest condition. At least from the Vedic perspective, let's say it in the negative side, it's not plausible. Give a scientist some neutrons and electrons and protons and make an atom. Or take a bunch of atoms and make life. You can say theoretical anything. But, you know, it's not supported by any experience we have. Rather, we have the experience that life creates life, and the elements of the Vedic picture is the elements come from a source, and the intelligence guiding those elements is that source also. That the Vedic picture of where things come from. So, the foundation of the Paramanuvada is the atom is the smallest divisible form of matter, or particle of matter. So whatever that is, divide and divide and divide, and you can't divide any further. Whatever that is, that's this Parama Anu. And everything is made up of Parama Anus, in different combinations and permutations. And the orderliness of it all is just chance. And we're supposed to say, yeah, I like that explanation. Take care of the need of God, an intelligence behind things. Anyway, this is the Vedic definition of an atom. Now, since the Vedas have their perspective, I thought it would go one step further and say, there's a definition of a point from geometry. We all learned this in geometry class. I know a young devotee that's doing an online geometry class because they had surgery and they can't go to school because they got surgery, so they're doing an online geometry class. So a point has no length and breadth. So what's that? Doesn't have any dimension at all, and that's what a point is. It's theoretical. But, you know, take it another step further. There's, of course, there's Vedic philosophers of math and so forth, but Archimedes from Greece, straight line is the shortest distance between two points. But two points don't have any length or breadth, and it's the shortest distance. And a more modern one is an infinite set of points that extends in two directions having length, but no width and thickness. Which to me sounds like really silly. How many is an infinite number of something that has no length and breadth, and you line them up and it makes a line? And then it goes into three dimension, into a plane. And so point has no length and breadth, but the soul does. 1/10,000 of a hair. But the soul is a spiritual dimension. It's to give us the short message here. It's to give us an idea that the soul is, I mean, very tiny. It's tinier than the atom, which is the smallest particle of matter. And yet it moves matter. A tiny atma moves the body of a big elephant. Or a body of a fly, or a body of whatever the size of the body is. The soul is very powerful. Next is Paramatma. What's he noticing?
Yeah, since she saw this picture in the camp, they had spring camp
recently. Do you know who that is? Who? Who? Narada. 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 Yes, it's Narada. So, what's he seeing inside? He's seeing Paramatma. Narayana, yeah. So, there's the form, these two, the upper portion of the form of the Lord of the Heart, Paramatma. And there's description in the Vedas about the size of Paramatma. The measurement, this is purport of Bhagavatam 2:28. The measurement of the localized personality of Godhead is estimated to expand from the ring finger to the end of the thumb, more or less 8 inches. Now, more or less 8 inches, at the same time, all the universes are within him, at the same time, he's within every atom. Now here's the Svetashvatara Upanishad, just a part of one verse. Measuring the size of a thumb, the Purusha is always present as the Supersoul within the hearts of all living beings. So, one devotee asked Prabhupada, what's the size of the Parama of an ant? It was the size of a thumb, or the size of 8 inches. Does that mean he's like dragging Super Soul around the ground as he's walking? I don't understand that, Prabhupada. Prabhupada's answer was, this thumb measurement of the Super Soul is imagined in proportion to the body of the living entity. So meaning that elsewhere is described by other acharyas, that because the heart is the size, more or less the size of a thumb, Paramatma is said to be the size of a thumb in Svetashvatara Upanishad. But that's, you know, in proportion to the body, human body. And it's just to give an idea. And so some people ask, what happens when there's a heart transplant? You get changed out with your soul and your karma? But no, it's in the region of the heart and it's animating the whole body from that place of the heart. So it's just like a machine part. You pull one out, put another machine part in. And now, number three. This three quarters, one quarter. This is Mahavishnu. And from the body of Mahavishnu, these are all universes that are emanating from him. Look very closely at one of them. You see Garbhadakshaya Vishnu reclining in the bottom half of each ocean, of each universe. Lord Brahma is coming from him, etc. And then this is all within this cloud of the material energy, and beyond the cloud of the material energy is the spiritual sky. And then within the vastness of the spiritual sky, there's Goloka, where Krishna resides. And where Krishna resides is unlimited. And even we say, you know, the number of universes are too many to account and to assign a finite number to. So we say unlimited universes. Too many to count universes. Notice that image of Mahavishnu is the same here as here. Here is just shown, you know, within or around him are the universes and the galaxies and this is and that's. And he's spoken about in the very revered Rig Veda. In fact, these Purusha Sukta prayers are very respected. It's the Purusha Sukta prayers that Lord Brahma and the demigods are reciting to Lord Vishnu when they went to the shore of the Milk Ocean. They recited the Purusha Sukta prayers, calling the Purusha. And so here's this one quarter portion down here, just an artist illustration. There's Mahavishnu and Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Shivadakshaya Vishnu is too small, you can't see him. But he's there. The Purusha avatars are spoken of in this Purusha Sukta prayers. And this is the vastness of the spiritual sky with the spiritual planets. Here's another illustration of the same. The cover of First Canto Bhagavatam. So we're almost done. There's only two slides left. So get ready for an abrupt ending. Here's the two verses from Purusha Sukta that are describing this three quarters, one quarter. The past, present, and future universes are manifestations of the Lord's powers. But the Lord himself is much greater. All the living beings of the universe are but one quarter portion, and the eternal nature of the spiritual sky exists in the three quarters portion. So this is referring, this is on the illustration on the left, obviously, is the universal form. It's describing the Purusha avatars manifesting the universe, the one quarter portion, because they're the three quarters portion. And then the next one, the three-quarters portion of the Lord transcends the material portion. The Lord in the one-quarter portion manifests the universe again, as he had done repeatedly before. The Lord of the one-quarter portion began the work of creation by going all around taking the form of all animate and inanimate objects. That means by his potencies. Not everything is God. And lastly, in the straight from our, you know, folio from Veda base, there are procedures for worship of Shalagram Shiva. And the worshipper of Shalagram Shila, because they're worshipping Narayana, they're, as they do each of the procedures, technically, there's chanting of the Rig Veda mantras. And the Padya and Argya portion include those two Rig Veda mantras that we just recited. It's part of worshipping Shalagram Shiva in our rituals. Of course, not everybody knows all those rituals and not knows all the mantras. They just make the offerings as the procedure says, but the mantras that accompany them in our Gaudiya practice is the Purusha Sukta mantras. Is some portion of them. So how are we to understand this? Back to the question. Three quarters of something that's unlimited. Just to give us an idea. The material creation, as vast as it is a fraction of the totality of everything. And is to give us just some idea. You can't measure something with a material yardstick that's unlimited. But it's to give us an idea. Each of these, the soul, the super soul, and the vastness of the spiritual sky compared to the material creation. So I'm ready to take questions, or I can go on to the one other thing. 20 after 8. I'll just touch on this one other thing and then see if you're all like bewildered or want to go home already. One devotee raised a question, one of our youth somewhere. I want to be a nice devotee, and I sometimes feel some material attachments at pulling on me, and I sometimes even just like contemplate those objects of material attachment. And how do I stay fixed on making spiritual choices instead of material ones? This is, you know, the life of a young person who is trained in Krishna consciousness from childhood, which is a great fortune. It says something about their previous life. And now they're becoming young adults and making choices. And if, because adult life means you make choices and they want to make the right choices, how do I consistently make the right choices even when I'm feeling pulled or attracted to material choices? What are some instructions you can give me to help me in that? So I think that's a nice question for all of us, and certainly those that are parents have a big concern about their children making good choices, and the congregation leader is concerned about the parents making good choices, because that's going to set the standard for, you know, at least the example for the next generation to make good choices. So if you want your children to make good choices, make good choices. If you want children to move in a spiritual direction, move in a spiritual direction. Just on this topic of when I was asked to speak at the University of Texas, one of the acharyas of social activism is Mahatma Gandhi, who was the role model for Martin Luther King. So Martin Luther King followed Mahatma Gandhi and read Bhagavad Gita and the whole thing. And similarly, what's his name from South Africa?
Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, Nelson Mandela. similarly viewed Mahatma Gandhi and Bhagavad Gita in a special way. So social activists, there's some connection between social activists and the message of Bhagavad Gita. And one of the statements of that Mahatma Gandhi is attributed to having said, whether he said it or not, some people question. you need to act the way you want the world to be. You know, it's the inside out approach of using that phrase. There's a scholar, an American scholar, who said that's not exactly what he said. And it's something a little bit more profound, but it has to do with God. Not just, you know, you influence people because you're in the mode of goodness and that helps people come to the mode of goodness. But, you know, there's providence. And the will of providence, when he sees you trying to please him, he, providence helps bring that into the world, not only into your life. It's a God-centered, you know, very clearly a Vaishnava perspective. There's a, you know, specific quote in that regard. So, the world, one answer to a young person is, besides what, you know, mom and dad said, and the, you know, what you learned in Sunday school, and what you know that's in Bhagavad Gita, just like, for example, when I was at College Station, Texas A&M, one student came who said, my mother's from Punjab, my father's from Orissa, and they're Krishna worshippers. I, as a young girl, I recited Vishnu Sahasranam practically every day. I memorized half of Bhagavad Gita by heart. And I knew the whole thing. We would regularly go to Krishna temples. And then something happened. And she didn't tell me what that something was. But, you know, bad things happened. And then I kind of, there was this big disconnect, and I've been floating ever since. And I can't talk to my mom and dad about this, because they would just, it would break their heart, they'd be too upset. And I kind of, like, I recognize that I've been given valuable jewels, but I don't want them. But, you know, yet I want them. But I can't connect. What do I do? So, just similar, like, that's an extreme case, and she was practically in tears. How to make good choices. Well, look at the world. This is one answer. Look at the world that's moving in a certain direction. A material direction. Increasing in various ways. And is it wholesome? Is it something that you want for your life? You know, because you go in the material direction, and one step leads to the next step, leads to the next step, leads to the, in the current of the flow of the material energy. And just step back from the whole thing, and what does it look like? It's one of the, say the same thing in a different way. It's one of the principles that our Bhakta leader shared with me. When somebody moved into the Bhakta ashram, and after some time their material attraction started to rise again, they would say, I think I want to leave. And sometimes just leave without saying anything. So that one of the protocols for the Bhakta leader was to say, okay. And you take them through this imagined, what's going to happen when you leave? Where are you going to go? What's that going to be like? Because they came from there, they left that. And then what's going to happen next, and what's going to happen next? Is that really what you want? No, it's not really what I want. So let's go back to, you know, what's irritating you. The irritation of material attraction is, what? Like, get to the root of it. And, you know, it's so the spirit of being an independent enjoyer, and so there's this rebellion and sense gratification, etc., etc. So what's the life of sense gratification? What's it look like? Put it on a big scale or a small scale. What's it look like? What does it feel like? Where's the train take you when you get on that train? Where does it go? Or say on the other side. Those that have in their upbringing, this is devotee children, they have the experience, if there's a wholesome family that they're growing up in, that they have some experience of contentment and happiness. So it's very important for parents to provide an atmosphere in the home such that the children, when they're in that stage of life where they're making approaching adult decisions, they want to do the right thing because it's the right thing. Not just because, and the affection that they feel, the happiness and contentment that they feel. Devotees have shared with me, and won't go into the anecdotal part, that before chanting and then after chanting, you know, growing up and then taking up the process of sadhana bhakti and taking in the association of devotees and taking Krishna prasadam, not just because it tastes good, but it does something to the body. Someone was sharing with me, they attended a function. They thought that what was being served was prasadam, but it wasn't. And they felt sick. It was vegetarian food, but they just didn't. Wasn't the same feeling. So they asked somebody, was this cooked by devotees and is it Krishna prasadam? They said, oh, you didn't know. Just once you're accustomed to the atmosphere, the incubation chamber of bhakti, stepping outside of that, it's harsh. It's a harsh, cruel world. So, the choice of materialism, where does it take you? Attraction for enjoying the senses, where does the path take you? And it doesn't work just to say in moderation, because in moderation is never moderation. It always keeps escalating. Just the nature of the thing. I shared this story a number of times, but I'll say it again. When I was young, our family moved from one place to another place. And when we went to the other place, the new place, the minister, Presbyterian Church, the minister from the new place came to greet us. Oh, welcome to our community. You know, that kind of thing. And when he came to visit, in the Western hospitality, would you like a place to sit and some water? But my parents, would you like something to drink? Would you like some coffee? Would you like some wine? Would you like some water? What would you like? He said, I'd like some wine. And my older brother and sisters said, is it okay for a priest to drink wine? And his answer was, in moderation. And I was a little kid. I was, second grade or something like that. And I thought, forget this guy. In moderation. Next thing you know, it's in moderation mixing with another man's wife. 10 years later, that's exactly what happened. They had to run the guy out of town because he was in moderation. mixing with congregants' wives. He was a married man, wasn't, you know, sannyasi, or, you know, celibate monk. He was a married man, very lovely wife, fine person. But, you know, the principle was in moderation. It's a mean bully that you're tangling with when you go into that in moderation principle. Not a nice guy. Beat you up bad. So where's that path take you? The even in moderation path take you? Something unwanted. So to make decisions based on fear, that I never liked that one. But it's just, you know, one's eyes should be open and reality should see when I'm making choices, what's the consequences of those choices? I should be informed. When I make this choice, there's this consequence, plus minus. That choice is that consequence, plus minus. And a life of devotion is nice. There's verses in Bhagavad Gita that speak of contentment within. And when there's content, so let me strive for that, because that's a worthy thing to strive for. And if striving for the contentment within means I forgo something that's a material attraction, because, you know, to be honest, there's some attraction. That's what this young person was saying. There's some attraction. How do I stay spiritually strong and make spiritual choices instead of fall for the material attraction ones? Spiritual strength. And spiritual strength in the sense of having experience of contentment within. When circumstance comes, sadhana becomes weak or whatever it is, we don't feel the same. You know, life becomes difficult, external and internal. Life becomes difficult. And conversely, when sadhana is strong, we can endure all kinds of things. The storm can come and go, and it's okay. There's strength. So let me make spiritual choices, because therein lies strength that allows me to navigate my way through the complexities of life. And young people have their complexities as much as older people have their complexities. It's a different set of complexities. Give you strength. And ultimately, a loving connection with Krishna. And that's really big. That's the goal. Good association will also help the young person, an older person, any person, walk the path of spiritual choices. Because when there's periods that we become weak, there's somebody by our side that's not weak. They can remind us and support us and help guide us, correct us, hold our hand and take us back to the middle of the road in the safe zone. Good association. And happiness in that good association. That happiness doesn't compare to any kind of the material happiness attraction. It doesn't compare at all. The devotee is a good devotee association, so important. We have to be good association for one another, right? Okay, so those are the two topics I wanted to cover. Any discussion?
Can I ask this question regarding non-moving?
Non-moving souls, and the souls are everywhere, is the point you mentioned.
I'm with you.
I did not have this clarity till now. Non-moving souls and souls are everywhere means in this room, along with the bodies, the soul inside, and what is the outer space? Are the souls existing in outer space right now? When it makes a statement everywhere.
Krishna makes the statement.
Can you please help me process that?
Just hear it again and again. That's how you can process it. It is what it is. There's different states of consciousness. Human form. Within this body, how many souls? Living off of the food that you eat. Or the organs, you know, within your body, is there? There's different states of consciousness. So there's this very, it's not often spoken of, but Haridas Thakur refers to it. So there's souls everywhere. And with the soul, the super soul, with the super soul, the souls. That are atoms everywhere. Where they're not atoms within material creation.
Thank you.
Yes.
Presentation on spiritual measurements.
Yeah.
I found very awe-inspiring and humbling, especially the content about the multiple universes alongside the size of the soul. So the sense of insignificance was very strong. At the same time, I was questioning myself about I can accept that me as this insignificant jiva floating around in this material energy, I have rebelled against Krishna, and therefore I'm here. And you know, I've got this enjoyment program and independent mindedness, etc. What I seem to have struggled with is to accept that so many souls in so many universes
doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's one quarter.
So many of us have made.
But there's so many more that we're tiny in comparison.
I was wondering if you could comment on how can so many people make the same mistake?
Well, it's variations on the theme of there's so many souls that make the right choice, and there's variations in the spiritual realm of without limit. We're marginal. We can properly or misuse free will, and we need a lot of mercy to get back. But I'm not directly addressing your question. Is how is it possible? It's just this misuse of free will is within our power. Free will is within our power. Free will is free will. And can you misuse? Why is it so astounding? You know, whatever the number is, it's just the principle. The principle is more astounding than the number. You know, the usual one is, you know, everything's so great, why do we leave it? it's from within. It's not, the cause is not something outside, the cause is something inside. That's the problem. It's not something, you just change something outside and now it's taken care of. There's something inside. That's the deeper concern. The first part of what you said. That's the deep one. How is it possible? Because all living entities have that potential. Proper misuse. And to correct that misuse, it's a profound transformation. Not just an adjustment of something outside. Anything else? Yes.
Right, I had one question and one comment.
I was hoping you would have more than one question, more than one comment.
So, first the question. So you mentioned about this, the Paramahansa theory by Kananda.
Yeah.
It says the atom is the smallest.
Yeah.
But according to modern science, the atom is divisible and
yes,
it has
particles
and neutrons.
Within, yeah.
Right, exactly. So how do you understand this from that? Is the atom is just the name for that, whatever is the indivisible? Or?
Yes. Yes. Whether Kanada was aware of the particles within an atom, Paramanu means the smallest of visible, the small, whatever that is. So now there's divisions within the atom. So what's the smallest? I'm not a scholar of Kanada's teachings, but you know that which is the building block, because you need this and that within one unit. So whatever that one unit is, that's the smallest. It has maybe subparticles, but it's, you got to have those subparticles to make one of those. So that's the Paramanu. Might find him still.
In the comments, so yeah, so it's actually very interesting to see how the modern scientists like us, those who are really genuine ones.
Yeah.
So they can, they try to understand it from a different point of view, but they come to the same conclusion.
Which
as,
is?
For example, you talked about these multiple universes.
Yes.
So in the last few decades, there have been a branch of mathematics, physics, it's called string theory, and it actually predicts that there are multiple universes, and they call it multiverse theory. So you cannot have just a single universe, but you have multiple such universes. And they, of course, I don't think they know about Vedic wisdom, but they just come to this the same conclusion, basically. And it's not mainstream. Many people think it's like philosophical, and they don't really accept it. But it's really there. And they also calculate what's the probability that we can find life by chance on one of these. And the probability is zero, almost zero. So that means that life cannot just happen by chance. So that really contradicts the Darwin's theory, that life doesn't happen by chance. So I just found it very, very interesting.
But, that's what they get paid for. Do the research and write their papers. Maybe sometime we'll have a discussion on, there have to be some foundational premises to reach these conclusions. Is it like reverse energy field? To have this, you have to have that. So therefore, there must be, because you have to have this, you have to have that. Is it that kind of logic?
Yeah.
Yes? So it's by inference. Inferring something to have this, you have to have that. It's not anything other than theoretical models of things. I didn't read the article. I just saw some little thing that Hawkins, one of the final things he was speaking about was this parallel universes, plural, not just one, but multiple. Yeah. Back, Prabhupada.
Maharaj, just a comment on Yamala Jivan Prabhu's point about so many people, how we can make the same mistake and things like that. I think when we see the one-fourth, the three-fourth is, we generally have an idea that three-fourth is pretty much empty. But there are souls over there populated heavily than one-fourth of the creation also. So compared to the entire three-fourth and one-fourth, there's more in three-fourth compared to one-fourth.
Well, I said that several times, but he's still saying, well, you'll even take the one-fourth, that's a lot of souls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Within one universe and unlimited numbers of universes, and there's a lot of souls, and you know, how can so many souls make the same boo-boo? Aside from comparing to the ones that didn't. Just how can somebody make that mistake? That's a dumb mistake. That's the...
You mentioned about the example of somebody approaching you, and then you followed up with statements about how we have to teach the kids to make right choices.
That's exactly what I said before. I said you have to model a life of making spiritual choices so they can see that's what it looks like. And that you're happy, they think, oh, that makes you happy, you make spiritual choices. But go ahead. Not just teach the kids to make spiritual choices.
So practically, dealing with Prahlad, we feel sometimes we can tell him, teach him to make correct choices.
You got a special service. Krishna's blessed you.
But there are sometimes when we have to give some kind of a material reward in order to make him make that spiritual choice. Hmm. Is that the right thing to do? I mean, so our thinking at least is, if he hears the transcendental sound vibration in some way, it'll help him, you know, as he grows. But on the other hand, that, you know, one part of me says maybe that's not the right way to do it. I know I'm not trained on parenting in that level, but from
an intuitive sense, you're not sure that's the best way to go.
Correct.
Well, best is one thing, and Prahlad is another thing. he's a special soul. So it's not like, you know, bend the rules because he's Prahlad, but you have to meet reality with your resources. And if you know where you want to go, you're not just doing out of convenience, but you know where you want to go, I would say, not being a parent, but being a spiritual guide of sorts for some people, making that step to help the dependent move in the direction of right choices for reasons you just mentioned. Knowing that down the line, I want that dependent to move, you know, beyond getting the reward. But it's, you know, going to be a little difficult because here they are being addicted to the reward. Or doing because they get the reward, and then if they don't get the reward now, you know, see you later. You have to begin somewhere. So to that I would say, so I'm giving you like, the response I'm giving you is, deal with reality and show, model, you know, the no reward picture. We do because it's for Krishna, not because we get some reward. You can convey that more effectively by your character than by your words to your son. Because you'll model it yourself. And when you see there's some opportunity to take them for your son to take the next step, or as any dependent to take the next step, you know, the light's on and you're ready to move to that next step. You have to begin somewhere. Okay. Yes?
I have a question on each of the two topics you presented this evening. One on the topic of guiding right choices. You're expressing one option is to walk them through what happens when you make this choice or when you make that choice. Yesterday you said something which you know, I've been processing. You said, even if there's inattentiveness to ordinary dealings with life, Krishna protects his devotees. Even if there's inattentiveness to ordinary dealings with life, Krishna protects his devotees. It was presented yesterday in Kalad Maharaj's prayers. So sometimes I find in the lives of these devotee children, because they are special souls,
yes.
You know, multiple instances I've seen, I'm not just talking with my own, but somehow, you know, magical things happen in their lives when, you know, a calamity could have happened, and Krishna protects these devotees. So sometimes I find it tough to even walk them through the circumstance of, you know, because in many ways they're sheltered from a consequence that could have looked pretty bad. So to walk them through that circumstance of what could have happened if you made this bad choice is sometimes challenging for me.
Well, you can do this, I'll respond this way. You can do this by having, you know, asking them, people that you see that take those choices, what happens in their life? Just, you know, two sharings from youth that I interact with. One is a girl that's now going to grad school, and is when she left home to go to undergraduate school, she said, "Wow, I had no idea how protected I was when I was growing up. You know what these students do is it's a shocker. I've been not feeling scared, just feeling protected. So now my values are protected because I know what's right, but you know, they're thinking something else." And then now it's grad school, and saying the Indian graduate students, so much like their life, so much involved in alcohol, that was their expression, aside from everything else, just the alcohol dimension. No, it's really tough. What they're going through, not like I'm tempted. Then others that are in their undergraduate level of school saying, you know, I and my friend are really clear that the whole thing with the boys and partying and drugs and, you know, there's not even a thought about saying no, it's just like, I'm not missing out on anything. Because I see what they're going through, and it's hell. So I'm not missing out on anything. So it doesn't have to be their own experience. It can be experiencing others that see them go through hell. Now, part of the problem is that they think they're having fun and they're missing out on fun. But you know, the reality is it's not fun. So that's something you, though they're protected, those that aren't protected, it's hell. Very hellish. And then keep going and keep going and keep going with the model. I asked as an example, I met some Chinese students at Illinois Institute of Technology. It was, first class at the beginning of the semester. This was a couple of years ago. Four or five of them came. And somehow the discussion came up about abortion. And they were saying, in China, if you didn't have abortion, you'd have a big problem. If the population is already too big. You gotta have it. Gotta have it. So I asked him, do you feel that before the Industrial Revolution, before the industrialization, that before the economy boom of China, when there was a very economy primarily in China, and today, is the quality of life better today? He said, definitely not. You know, is the quality of air better? Is the quality of life better? Definitely not. Crime level and quality of life is not better. So, and yet persons are now feeling they can't be happy unless they have a certain, middle class level of fashion and possessions and away from the land and more towards stuff. But the quality of life isn't better. So, there may be some points where some people, they bought into a certain paradigm, but the bigger picture of the quality of life isn't better. It's not too difficult to convince or to demonstrate, even though they're protected young devotees. The quality of life is... But, some just, they want to enjoy. And there's no brake pedal. There's hardly a steering wheel. So that's one. There's two.
On the topic of using material dimensions to understand spiritual subject matters, it takes a certain level of faith.
Yes.
And it's mostly just a waste of time, is it? With someone who doesn't have that faith.
Is what a waste of time?
To
explain these things? But this is not for a non-devotee audience. This is for a devotee audience. I'm not taking this to a college session. Go over the place with. Yeah, I take a certain level of faith. But he will come up with questions like this. They have doubts about the veracity of Vedic teachings because this doesn't seem to match with that they know from material science or from their observations or something. Their limited capacity to know things. Yeah, it takes some faith. Does that answer your question?
Yes. So, yeah, you answered it. This is not a presentation you would make in a college audience.
No.
It's for devoting, a devoting audience.
Yeah, specifically. Like the stir. You get complacency stirred a bit.
So I specifically asked this question because recently, there's a Christian high school that calls somebody from our temple to make a presentation every semester, and when I went last time, they asked a question about, you know, these high school boys, it's a boys' high school, about, you know, these kind of subjects in the Vedas, these fantastic things, and, you know, how does one, how do you have faith? And I feel like, you know, I'm not a scholar from any stretch of imagination, and I have faith, but, you know, I can't quote, and I can't, and I just can't remember, I can hardly understand these things myself, what to speak of explaining. So is it just, you know, for a person like that,
for a person like the student or a person like you?
Yeah. When faced with the challenge of, you know, how do you trust these things that are given in the Vedas? Is it just, you know, my level of faith and as purity comes over time?
Well, I would say these two things, that it's the Madhyama position. You may not be able to answer all questions from scriptural authority, but there's faith in principle. And the faith in principle is based upon experience of what you do know and you do relate to, and it's wholesome. And you have faith in the goal, you have faith in the persons who are presenting the goal, so that's the basis of your faith. And second is, by interacting with persons that ask that question, it helps create an impetus to read more carefully, not become a bookworm, kind of, so I think that an answer to everything, not that kind of, you know, I've got a sword and a saber and got a spear and got all these weapons and I can deal with people that come at me. But so that you have the big picture. And as you get the big picture, the answer is there. Like, you know, these are speaking, for example, it's speaking of other dimensions, heavenly dimensions. It doesn't say which dimension it's in, so the size of trees and the size of mountains, and, you know, it's not this dimension, it's that dimension, for example. So as you become more conversant with scripture and writings of our acharyas, then, you know, then you have the information. And if you have a good memory, then you can say, this is what it says over here about this, and there's what. But, you know, one answer you could give, if there's some particular question, I'll research this. Because I know it's within our scripture that, you know, I have that faith. But it's not a blind faith, it's a reasoned faith. Yes. Now,
Maharaj, what's your recommendation? What's the practice for one to become self-realized?
The practice to become self-realized?
Meaning, well, what is
I'm surprised you're asking that question.
Atma. How can we see Atma?
You can't. You want to see an Atma?
Yes.
Why do you want to see an Atma?
All
so
we are talking, most
seeing
of
is believing for that reason.
No, my question is just because most of the time we speak, we are not this body, we are Atma. Are you speaking out of realization or the theoretical understanding?
Well, I'm not sure where you're coming from with this question. I mean, let's just because we know of the presence of the soul by its symptoms. Just like, you know, I'm not an electrical engineer. No, to my knowledge, no one has seen an electron, correct? We know that electrons exist. There's a whole field of electronics. We know of the presence of an electron by its symptoms, what it does. And therefore we know that electrons exist. Or scientists know. And we live with electrons. We use electricity all the time to do all kinds of stuff. So, although we've not seen one, nor will we, but we know it exists. Or we know that the mind exists, although we've not seen one. We know that time exists, although have you ever seen a time?
So we know that it exists by its influence. And we can just study it, we can discuss it, we can understand it without seeing. So similarly with the soul, by its symptoms. And so our reliance on understanding these more subtle, what to speak of, transcendental things is descending knowledge, and that's the authority that we rest upon. I mean, that's similar to Sri Radhika's question. That's the authority. You don't have to see the soul to be fully convinced that the soul exists, simply because Krishna says it exists. And what are the symptoms of the soul? We can observe phenomenally the influence of noumenal, the influence of spirit within this realm. You have to see it. We speak of it, but you don't have to see it in order to be convinced, yes, it's true. See its influence. Am I addressing your question adequately, or you're still not satisfied?
No, certainly we are addressing the question, but I think I am not able to present my question in a way that can be addressed more clearly. I have to think about
it. You think about it, we'll discuss another time.
Thank you.
Last question up front. We're going to end. 10 after 9.
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. This is regarding making the good, correct choices. Since we have here teenagers, couple of youths here, so
yeah,
I want to project this question. They are in the stages, you know, as a parent we are with them up to certain stage of their life, and then we are teaching them whatever best we can do, and being the devotee kids, and they are also very good in practicing all that. So when they reaches, there is a chance, like all the chance, I mean, to go out of the home and, you know, for the education part, or after that, you know, work and everything. So how do they know, and there is also the education system and the social things around them and the peer pressure, everything is there that they have to balance being a devotee also and lot of in many ways, and they're pretty much really good to do that. But how do they know that they are making a good, correct choices in every part of their life, like selecting, going to the education side and having a good association of friends, because they might really need friends when they are out of their home, you know, when they are staying in college or anywhere in the work area. So how do they make themselves that, are they doing it? Because nobody can watch them or tell them, be closer to them and be with them to, you know, advise them. And
I think you're repeating. I get the picture. I get the idea. There's going to be trial and error. He wants the microphone. There's going to be trial and error. As with you. So also with the teenager. But, you know, if the compass is set straight, you know, heading towards Krishna, then the trial and error is going to be self-adjusting. Because it's, I want to please Krishna, and I want to be connected with Krishna, and I want to be following my spiritual master, because he's going to take me to Krishna. That's what I want. So when that is strong, the self-adjusting element will come into play. When bhakti is strong, you get to the destination. It's certainly the smaller, medium, and big decisions. The big decisions are more important, but, you know, all levels of decisions, even if you make a big decision that wasn't the best decision, it can be recalibrated. As long as there's, you know, the bhakti principle is intact. So that has to be nourished. But, you know, from the parenting side, you can't, you know, sit on the egg forever. The egg's going to hatch.
And then the soul, that's part of parenting. See the soul make the transition to the next position by making wise choices. And sometimes, you know, not wise choices are made. But the correction, the correcting mechanism is bhakti. I'm going to end. So, it's late. I just looked at my watch and said, she's a Prabhupada.
Yeah.